Hello, everyone. This is Jeffrey Kerr. I hope you are all enjoying your holiday season. As 2021 is coming to a close, this will mark the end of the third year of the Kerr Reviews podcast. So today, I thought it would be fun to take a look back at what 2021 has been like with this show. Once again, I was lucky enough to have gotten such a wide variety of different guests this past year. Some of them were people I pursued for interviews and succeeded in booking myself. Others, I received offers from representatives about getting to speak with their clients. I'd like to take this moment to highlight some of the guests I was able to have on the Kerr Reviews podcast throughout 2021. Back in May, I got to interview a business entrepreneur who has produced live comedy shows, TV series, concerts, and even has his own comedy club titled Laughs Unlimited. R. Scott Edwards managed to build that into a chain of the most successful comedy clubs in America. Over the years, he has brought his vast experience working with some of the most famous names in comedy, such as Jay Leno, Jerry Seinfeld, Bob Saget, and Dana Carvey. After I introduced Scott on the show, he greeted me and everyone else listening with this.
Ladies and gentlemen, good to see you, Jeffrey. Thank you. Thank you, people. Thank you. It's exciting to be here. That's enough of that. Okay, good to be here.
One of my favorite parts of our conversation together was about a very important topic that is pretty much on the minds of a lot of people who use social media. And cancel culture has pretty much become a trend within the past couple of years in the press and on the internet. Do you think comedy can survive such a thing?
It is definitely dampening all of entertainment. I think that politics doesn't belong in schools. It doesn't belong in our healthcare. It doesn't belong in our entertainment sanctum. But it is there. And I was just on a Clubhouse meeting that I do every Tuesday with some comics. And we were talking about just that subject. And they were saying that it's just such a different vibe that back in the 80s and 90s, stand-up comedy is the last bastion for free speech. So you could pretty much say and do whatever you wanted. And the audience knew that it was meant to be funny. And that if somebody got offended, let's say out of an audience of 200, if one or two people got offended, that was kind of on them. But in today's stand-up world, with this woke environment, everyone's not only aware of their own sensibilities, but they're projecting onto the everybody else in the audience. And so, oh, he did a joke about a Russian, you know, are there any Russians in the room? You know, I mean, it's just ridiculous that they're trying to expand what they think is empathy and caring really to an overzealousness to find problems with it when it's just entertainment. You know, that's what you got to remember, folks. You can't laugh at yourself. Don't laugh at all.
Well, yeah, I'm someone who always believes that one must never run away from their problems. They must face them. And sure, you know, people do complain, oh, do late night talk show hosts and award show hosts need to get political? Like, people say, no, the award shows should not get political. But, well, sometimes it's your own damn fault for the shows getting political to begin with, because it may have been a result of what you did in the elections.
Exactly. And you stated it so well that I think it turns off the audience when you turn everything that's supposed to be, I mean, entertainment, whether it's singing, dancing, magic, or juggling, is meant to be escapism. You want to get away from the problems of the world or your family or your job. And to bring it to entertainment and sports, for example, I think defeats the purpose. We're supposed to have some way to not deal with everyday issues. And that's what all entertainment should be, whether it's sports or theater. And in stand-up comedy, they have the extra pressure that it's just them on stage. And so being able to entertain the audience in this woke environment can be very challenging. It's not as much fun. That's too bad.
Well, yeah, like, I personally think a good idea, look, if you want to get political, at least don't do the political jokes right away. At least make the audience feel welcomed and then do the political jokes later on, because then the audience will pretty much has no way out of it.
Well, and you're right. And that actually holds true for anything you're going to talk about. You want to get the audience to know you a little bit. I mean, one of the things about stand-up comedy is you're exposing yourself to a room full of strangers. And once they understand who you are and that you're there to entertain them and not preach to them, then you can go out and do a little bit more edgy material, and they'll go with you because the audience wants to be entertained. But it's getting harder and harder.
Also back in May, the Durham Performing Arts Center here in North Carolina held their Triangle Rising Star Awards, which celebrates the best of high school musical theater performances in the Triangle area. The winners every year go on to compete at the Jimmy Awards in New York City. The Best Actress winner in Durham, Elena Holder, actually managed to win Best Actress at the Jimmys. I got to interview her, along with the Triangle's Best Actor winner, Joshua Messmore, the day after their victories. What you're about to hear are excerpts of the interview involving Elena in particular.
And going back to the beginning, how did each of you get involved with this year's Triangle Rising Star Awards?
I was in Triangle Rising Stars my freshman year, and I've been involved in the program since then through my school. But when it came out that there was going to be a virtual one this year, I was super stoked, and I applied myself, so it was really cool.
And as Clay Aiken was reading off the lists of finalists in both categories one last time before announcing the winners, what was going through your minds?
I was so nervous. I was like breathing funny, but I was shocked when he called my name. It was like, oh my gosh, really? I'm super excited, and this summer is going to be awesome. And it was just nerve-wracking at first.
And how excited are the two of you to be going to New York City this summer to compete at the Jimmy Awards?
It's going to be insane. I'm so, so excited. I think we're doing it virtually this year, but virtual New York will be amazing.
Well, yeah, makes sense because we may be slowly coming out of this pandemic, but probably it's still safer to do, you know, big events like these virtually for the time being.
Yeah. They look like they have a really good, like, setup for it. It'll be really fun.
And moving forward, is musical theater something each of you would like to pursue as a career?
I'm going to college next year for vocal performance and psychology. And I hope to use a vocal performance degree to kind of pursue musical theater after college. I want to go to New York and do the whole audition circuit. It would be super cool.
Back in September, I got to interview a playwright and poet named Dan O'Brien. At the time, he had just debuted a collection of essays titled A Story That Happens, which chronicled an uplifting story. He and his wife, improvisational comedian Jessica St. Clair, had both survived cancer at separate points in their marriage. So I learned quite a bit about those experiences from Dan himself.
To start things off, would you mind telling us about A Story That Happens?
Yeah, it's a collection of essays that first began as lectures that I gave at the Sewanee Writers Conference. It's a writers conference in Tennessee for playwrights, fiction writers, poets, and as of this summer for nonfiction writers as well. And I've been a playwriting faculty there many summers over the last 20 years. So each one of the essays in the collection was a lecture that I delivered in 2017, and then one in 2018, 2019, and 2020. They're meant to be craft lectures about, I suppose, how to write a play. But I, you know, the only way I could really, you know, give a lecture about that was to make it quite personal and to try to tell my story about how I write plays, how I began writing plays, how I've changed my ideas about the type of theater I hope to create. And the essays were fundamentally influenced by having gone through and survived consecutive cancer treatments. One for my wife, she was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2015. 6 months later, I was diagnosed with colon cancer. So we had about a year and a half of catastrophe, I guess you could say, that's had so far a happy ending. So these essays were inspired and formed by that experience in a lot of ways, maybe most profoundly in terms of the idea that the trauma, I think, forces people to reconceive of themselves and their identities. And because I think that theater and playwriting is fundamentally about identity, I felt like there was a real overlap of interest here in talking about, you know, who I was post-cancer, and then to talk about how plays are about the transformation of identity, the transformation of characters, the transformation maybe of cultures in relation to theater.
And as you mentioned before, you were both previously diagnosed with different forms of cancer and survived. What is it like to look back at those experiences in hindsight?
You know, it's an ongoing, for some reason I hate this word process, but it is an ongoing process. You know, I think because I've written throughout my career, or ever since I started writing before I had a career, I've almost always written about trauma in one form or another. In some ways, it began as a kind of self-therapy to just to survive the trauma, but I do feel like I have a lot of experience for you know, the process of grieving that takes place, psychological, emotional healing, and how it happens in stages and fits and starts, you know, accepting. Part of what happens is it takes time to accept, you know, even if you've survived a trauma, you've been changed by it. So there are things, elements of yourself and your life that are gone. But all of those points of trauma for me have also been filled with a strange euphoria or elation, because I always felt that this was an opportunity to reinvent some aspects of my life, to recreate, but not to go back to how things were before, but to be creative again. That's assuming you can get through the trauma. And Jessica and I feel on a daily basis astonished and grateful and bewildered that we're still here, and knock on wood, doing well, no evidence of disease for many years now. Yeah, it's ongoing. The essays, it's interesting to me, it may be interesting to readers, the essays in the book, because they're written one a year, you know, you may be able to see or read or sense the progression of somebody coming out of the cave in some ways of illness, the isolation of illness. The last essay in the collection, again, tries to draw parallels to what we're all experiencing with COVID as we all try to emerge from isolation and return to quote unquote normal life. It hasn't happened yet, but in some ways it is happening. And also to look at the ways in which we're all wanting to go back to normal life, but also wanting to do things differently. I know the theater culture want to come back to a theater that's healthier in many ways. And that's certainly the experience of somebody who survives something like cancer. You want to get back to normal. At the same time, you want to get back to a better normal. You don't want to go back to the life that maybe in some ways led to cancer. I mean, cancer obviously can be completely random and nobody had any control over the pandemic, for example. But I think that period of forced isolation and reflection, whether it's cancer or the pandemic, allows people to reflect and see how they want to live differently and create differently for theater artists.
Back in November, Jedson Theatre Company in Pinehurst had two events involving writer Stan Zimmerman, the first of which was one where he discussed behind-the-scenes stories from his days of working on the first season of The Golden Girls. When I interviewed Stan the month before, I got to ask him about that, as well as a certain other TV show he got to work on. What was it like getting to write for the cast of that show?
A little overwhelming, to be honest, at first. I was so young and I didn't really think of myself as a really funny writer. It was comedy 101. I learned how to craft jokes. And, you know, those actors deserve the best of the best lines. And we worked all night giving them that. And they were very appreciative. I know at first there's stories about Bea Arthur, you know, would come down to the set and be like, who are all these young kids writing for me? Shouldn't there be all older people? And she was very skeptical. And then she read the scripts and she's like, okay, you all got it. And very rarely do you see this, but writers don't get a lot of accolades. And if you look back at all the talk shows, every single one of them, those four ladies commented and really said, it's the writing, it's all the writing. And that was really, really sweet and thoughtful of them to acknowledge us.
And you also got to work on what I know was a beloved television show for a number of people of a certain generation, Gilmore Girls. And what was it like getting to work on that?
You're lucky as a writer to have made, you know, I've been on one hit show. And the fact that I got to be on Golden Girls, Roseanne, and Gilmore Girls, I don't take that lightly. And I'm extremely grateful that my career went in that direction. And that's why I'm writing a book now. It's called The Girls from Golden to Gilmore. And it's about all the wonderful women I've worked with and Roseanne. And I will be telling stories about that experience.
In fact, what was it like getting to work for, you know, Amy Sherman-Palladino on Gilmore Girls, who, of course, now has gotten probably the biggest success of her career with The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel?
Yeah, so we met Amy on Roseanne, and I'll never forget that first day. We were all in the writer's room, and there were about 21 writers, and she wasn't in the room for some reason. And we were working on a Darlene story, which is the Sarah Gilbert character, and we figured it all out. Amy comes in with her top hat and fishnet stockings, and she rips the whole story apart. Darlene would never do this, da 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 da. And I just went, oh my God, who is this person? And after, you know, we took a coffee break, I went up to her and I was like, I have to know you. You're so brilliant. And we became fast friends. Because there were 21 writers, we'd break off into groups, and it was usually we were with Amy. And that's how we got to know her. Right before season 5 of Gilmore Girls started, she invited me and my writing partner, Jim Berg, to the Chateau Marmont. It's a really nice hotel bar in L.A. And she said, I want you to come for some time on Gilmore Girls. I want to be around friends and have you be there. And so we said, we'll give you a year of our life. I'm so grateful and glad I did do that.
The other events Judson Theater Company presented that involved Stan Zimmerman was a production of his play, Yes, Virginia. It starred veteran character actress Mindy Sterling and Broadway veteran Arneisha Walker. The latter I was able to interview. Two of her most notable credits on her resume involved appearing in the original stagings of The Wiz and Dreamgirls. I, of course, had to ask Arneisha about her experiences with both musicals, the latter of which most recently celebrated its 40th anniversary of when it originally opened on Broadway.
And in one of your follow-up credits, you got to be the standby for Stephanie Mills as Dorothy in the original Broadway cast of The Wiz. What was that like?
Well, first of all, doing The Wiz was a wonderful experience working with all of those talented people. Standing by, I mean, you're waiting for somebody to be sick to go on. And believe me, Stephanie never missed a performance while I was her standby. The week that I left, Stephanie took a 2-week vacation. She went on vacation. So I don't know if that was a compliment or what. They don't let you understudy on.
Well, hey, at least, you know, getting to be part of the creation of a new Broadway musical that's gone on to endure for many years.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and the talent that was in that. There were several performers that never made it to Broadway. You remember Butterfly McQueen from Gone with the Wind? She played Prissy, the young, I don't know nothing about birthing no babies, Miss Scarlett.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but by that time, you know, she was an older woman, except for she was a big, big star. Everywhere we went, they knew Butterfly, but she could never remember her blockings. God bless her. She was a wonderful lady, and she loved me. I loved her, too. But she couldn't remember her blocking or her lines. She didn't make it. And I don't know, do you remember the comic Stu Gillum? Because he was the original Scarecrow. He left right before we went to Broadway. And Hinton Battle, who ended up opening, literally had maybe a day's rehearsal as a Scarecrow when we opened. Yeah, there's so many backstage stories. I mean, it's a wonderful show. Yeah, I have really had the good fortune of being in some wonderful productions.
Oh, yeah. In fact, one of them I'm about to bring up. You're someone who holds the distinction of being the only woman to have played all three of the principal characters in Dreamgirls. And would you mind talking about your journey with that musical?
At the time when they were doing the workshops, I had heard about it. But I was out in L.A. and I was starving actor, and I couldn't afford to go to New York and be in a workshop. So I had heard about this. And then when it opened on Broadway, of course, you know, it was a sensation. And I borrowed the money for a plane ticket. And I think I paid like $10 for standing room only. And I stood in the back and I watched this show. I thought it was fabulous. And when Jennifer sang, and I'm telling you, I said, I've got to do this show. I've got to be in this show. When they were auditioning for the LA company, Michael Bennett and Michael Peters and Bob Avian, they all came out to LA. And I had really prepared for it. That audition was all day long. I kid you not. When I got cast in it, Michael didn't know what role he wanted me to play. So he paid me to come to New York and just learn Dina and Laurel. And I did. And of course, I ended up being cast as Laurel, the comedic role. But I always asked Michael, I said, Michael, can I, you know, understudy Effie? And he's like, no, you're all wrong. So we were in LA and Lilius White was Jennifer's understudy. But Lilius, at this particular performance, had gone to Washington, D.C. to sing at the Kennedy Center for the president. So she was singing there. Jennifer was sick. So around 4 o'clock on this particular day, Michael Bennett calls me and he says, Arnisha, you know how you always wanted to be Effie? And I was like, yeah. He's like, well, you're on tonight. Get over to the theater. And so my first performance as Effie, I literally had no rehearsal. But of course, I knew everybody's part. I knew every line of the show. From that point on, I did my regular role and I understudied Effie at the same time. Eventually, Jennifer left the company and then Lilius became Effie. And she had understudy, but I guess I already knew the role. So whenever Lilius was out, I would be Effie. I remember one performance, I was standing literally in the wings in my Laurel costume, ready for the overture to begin. The stage manager said, Arnisha, go get into the Effie costume. You're on as Effie tonight. You know, so I was already, you know, geared up. My psyche was into Laurel, but, you know, you had to switch it. Theater is very exciting. It's unpredictable. And there's no cut. Let's do that again. You truly have to be in the moment and you have to go with it, whatever.
So that's just about does it for the third year of the Care Reviews podcast. Before we go, let me take one last moment to thank the other guests I was able to have on the show in 2021. Howie Zales, Karen B., Jack Mahanes, Carl Hitchborn, Nancy Mamana, Joshua Messmore, Dustin Britt, Bob Bashir, AJ Schrader, Rankin Willard, Dylan Bailey, Ben Davis, and Drew Smith. I'll be back soon for year 4 and the beginning of 2022. If you love this show, please leave us a review. Go to ratethispodcast.com/carereviewspodcast and follow the simple instructions. Feel free to subscribe to wherever you get this podcast. If you'd like to find more content from me, please visit my website, which is www.carereviews.net. You can also find it on Twitter at @carereviews and me at @JeffreyCare. Thanks for listening, and I will see you all later.